It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll find out what's happened since the end last week of the immigration restrictions known as Title 42 and how new immigration policies are changing the conditions on the U.S. border with Mexico. First, you may not have heard much about private equity companies, names like Blackstone, Carlyle, and KKR. But there's a good chance they've had an impact on your life. Private equity has taken over businesses in retail, nursing homes, car rentals, healthcare, veterinary care, housing, the list goes on. And our next guest says they mostly change things for the worse. In his new book, he's spreading the word that massive, lucrative, often predatory, and relatively unknown financial firms are dramatically transforming our entire economy, our entire country. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you know about the private equity industry? Have you encountered it in one way or another? What do you want to know? Did you work at Shopko or Toys R Us before they closed down? They're big parts of this story. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Brendan Belew is a federal prosecutor and served as special counsel for private equity in the Justice Department's Antitrust Division. In his book and here on the air, he is not speaking on behalf of the Justice Department. His new book is called Plunder, Private Equity's Plan to Pillage America. Brendan, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, private equity, not necessarily a household phrase. Big picture, what is it?
So private equity is a term that maybe you've heard of, but if I think we're honest, many of us didn't actually know what it meant. And I have to confess, I didn't know really what it was until I started this project. The basic idea is very simple. Private equity firms use a little bit of their own money, some investor money, and a whole lot of borrowed money to buy up companies. They then make various financial and operational changes to those companies with the aim of selling them for a profit a few years later. It's a pretty simple idea, but for reasons that we can discuss, it often leads to bad outcomes for companies, for customers, and for employees.
Right. I can hear a good version of this story where, okay, this big company, it's struggling, poorly managed maybe. Here comes the private equity company, buys it, makes it more efficient, healthier, sells it off, everybody wins. The case you're making in your book is that is not usually what actually happens.
Yeah, and I don't want to overstate my case. There are many private equity deals that, you know, turn out successfully for, you know, not just investors, but for the companies themselves. But there are some basic problems with the private equity business model that lead to bad consequences very often. Very quickly, they are private equity firms tend to buy and hold the companies for just a few years. So they have a very short-term focus. They tend to load up the companies they buy with a lot of debt and extract a lot of fees. And most importantly, and this is the part that interests me as a lawyer, and again, I thank you for caveating that I'm speaking in a personal capacity and not necessarily that the opinion of the Justice Department. What's really interesting is they're very good at insulating themselves from liability for actions that they take or that their portfolio companies take. So when you have that combination of short-term focus, a lot of debt and fees, and limited legal liability, it often leads to bad results.
Can you talk us through the scope of private equity? I gave a few examples of industries, but how widespread are these kind of companies and the companies that they end up buying?
Private equity surrounds you. PE firms spent over $1 trillion buying companies last year. And just for a sense of scale, the entire U.S. GDP was about $25 trillion last year. You already touched on some examples, but if you go to a veterinary clinic or an OBGYN practice, if you buy clothes, pet food, or contact lenses, in some cities, the very water that you drink is provided by a private equity firm. I always joke that if you read my book, the private equity is literally right in front of you because the font that we use is owned and licensed by a private equity-owned portfolio company.
Let's look at a particular case with a lot of relevance here in Wisconsin. The business Shopko, now out of business. There's a spinoff eye care firm called Shopko Optical, but it's pretty much gone. And the examples you give in the story of Shopko are pretty common in a lot of these private equity buyouts, starting with some of the decisions made soon after a company gets bought. Can you talk us through Shopko and how it represents the wider story?
Absolutely. And Shopko is near and dear to my heart as a place that I, you know, went to a lot in southern Minnesota and Wisconsin growing up. So, you know, Shopko was bought by the private equity firm Sun Capital in 2006 or 2007. And then Sun Capital executed a number of tactics that are pretty common within the industry. For one thing, they executed what's called a sale leaseback, where they required Shopko to sell all of the real estate of the stores that they own and lease those stores back. That's a tactic that gave Shopko and its private equity owner a quick hit of cash, but now it meant that Shopko had to essentially indefinitely pay for something that it used to own. Sun Capital then executed a bunch of transaction fees and management fees, essentially fees that Shopko had to pay for the privilege of being owned by Sun Capital, as well as, I believe, executing what's called a dividend recapitalization, where essentially Shopko had to borrow money to pay Sun Capital and its other investors. All these tactics were tremendously successful for Sun Capital, the private equity owner, but as you know and many of your listeners do, it ultimately pushed Shopko itself into bankruptcy, and it essentially no longer exists as a business.
Talking to Brendan Belew about his new book, Plunder, Private Equity's Plan to Pillage America. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. Maybe your experiences if you worked for Shopko or Toys R Us or another business that's no longer in business after being purchased by a private equity company. Join in at 800-642-1234. Brendan, one thing that always baffles me in some of these private equity deals is, okay, I'm a private equity company. I'm buying company X over here. Some of the money I'm using to buy it ends up as a loan held by that company I just bought. So me buying it saddled that company with a lot of debt. How does that work? How does it impact the company?
It's a great question. And it's this sort of financial magic trick that private equity firms are able to do. So as I mentioned at the outset, and as you alluded to in your question, when private equity firms buy up companies, they use a lot of debt. But the really interesting thing is it's debt that the acquired company, not the private equity firm, typically holds. So in the case of when Carlyle buys the nursing home chain HCR ManorCare, which you know, some of your listeners may be familiar with, it did so for about $6 billion. Most of that was money that ManorCare had to hold on to rather than Carlyle. And as a result, ManorCare spent a lot of money just paying the cost of servicing the debt, which makes it harder for it to invest in facilities, invest in staff, and so forth.
Let's talk about what this means for different groups of people. First of all, employees. In case after case you give after a company is bought in this way, often they're sort of pension washed. Pensions that people may have counted on after working for a company for a long time disappear or go to another service. What happens?
So it's a really fascinating story. I'll give a quick example of when actually the same private equity firm, Sun Capital, bought up the diner chain Friendly's, which, you know, serve classic hamburgers and milkshakes and so forth. Friendly executed a lot of the same tactics that we were talking about sale leasebacks and so forth, and ultimately pushed Friendly's into bankruptcy. But Sun Capital wasn't just Friendly's owner. It was also Friendly's largest lender. And by doing that, in a bankruptcy process, normally the lender sort of get control of the company. Sun Capital was able to sell Friendly's from itself to itself. And the reason that it did that is by doing so in the bankruptcy process, Friendly's was able to push off the pension obligations that Friendly's owned onto what's called the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, which is a quasi-government agency that insures pensions. And so the result of that was that Sun Capital was allowed to keep a business that it had bankrupted, but it was able to lose the pension obligations that Friendly's employees and retirees depended on.
Then impact on consumers. And I want to focus in on one particular industry, care facilities. The senior care facilities sometimes end up in the hands of these private equity companies. And you write about reports of declines in care over time. What happens?
So I alluded to this in answering one of your earlier questions. Carlyle bought up the nursing home chain ManorCare and loaded up with debt, executed sale leasebacks. Ultimately, health code violations spiked and at least one resident died. The interesting thing is when the residents family sued for wrongful death, Carlyle was able to get the case against it dismissed, essentially by saying that it wasn't the technical owner of the nursing home chain. Instead, it merely advised a series of funds whose limited partners through several shell companies ultimately owned the nursing home chain. And that was enough to get the case against Carlyle dismissed. And I think it illustrates that point we were making, that oftentimes private equity firms insulate themselves from liability or for the consequences of their actions. And just to put a pin on that, there's been some really interesting research, because nursing homes are incredibly popular for private equity firms to buy. At least by one estimate, private equity firm ownership of nursing homes is responsible for over 20,000 premature deaths over a 15-year period.
We're talking to Brendan Belew about his new book. It's called Plunder, Private Equity's Plan to Pillage America. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest, with your experience. If you worked at a place or were a customer of a business that you relied on that was taken over by a private equity company, did it go well or poorly for you? Is your landlord one of these private equity companies? We'll get to your calls and some suggested changes that our guest has in mind. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation about private equity companies with Brendan Belew. He's a federal prosecutor. His new book is called Plunder, Private Equity's Plan to Pillage America. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Mike joins us now in Slinger. Mike, hi.
Hi, Rob. I'm familiar with the veterinary clinics. I heard that on public radio in a lot of small towns. They buy them up and then they run a bankrupt and then there's no vet left in the town. But my comment is that I think about 6 months ago, Kohl's went through this very thing with some private equity firm trying to buy them out. And somehow they fought them off. They wanted to put someone on the board. The equity company did, and they fought them off. But I remember them saying specifically that they wanted to rent the stores back to Kohl's. And your guest just mentioned that before, that's what happened to Shopko, and they just drained them. So I just thought I'd make that as a comment.
Mike, thanks for that call. Yeah, I see WPR reported on that very thing you're talking about, Mike. Thanks for sharing that. I want to mention Mike's other comment, Brendan, about veterinary clinics. I wouldn't think that would be a huge investment opportunity, but what is happening in that field, Brendan?
It's really interesting. Private equity is really attracted to veterinary clinics. And in fact, I think the largest veterinary chains in America are all owned by private equity firms now. I think veterinary clinics present a couple of opportunities for PE firms. One is, sort of during and after quarantine, pet ownership and spending on pets really rose dramatically. So they see it as a growth industry. It's also a fairly dispersed industry right now. And so I think private equity firms see it as a way to potentially roll up different businesses and combine them under one umbrella. That potentially has sort of benefits of scale, but it also potentially could raise prices for consumers or cut salaries for veterinarians and lab technicians. And in fact, the FTC just recently enjoined a recent private equity acquisition of a veterinary chain. So it's something clearly that PE is interested in.
Thanks a lot for that call. Mike joins us now in Marshall. Mike, hello.
Excuse me. I'm just cleaning up from No Mo Me.
I feel anyway, you, man.
I worked for Shopko, and I could almost believe that there was a layer of ripoff going before Sun Capital reared its head. But then when they showed up, it was obvious that they were running the place into the ground. There was places being bought, and they try and staff them. There wasn't any business, and they were just, there was just some game being played down in Florida, but it didn't really bother me because I was headed to greener pastures.
Mike, thanks for calling and sharing that experience with us. Brendan, yeah, Shopko not in great shape before that buyout by Sun. How does somebody make money, as Mike says, running this business into the ground?
Well, sometimes, it's a genuine effort to turn a company around and see if they can make a profit from it. But oftentimes, or at least sometimes, private equity firms can, make money by essentially selling the business for parts. you know, in a case of Marsh Supermarkets, which some of your listeners may be familiar with, the private equity firm, I think, realized that the assets of the real estate were worth more than the business itself. So they acquired it, sold the real estate, made their money back, and essentially just had a grocery chain to boot, you know, that was just sort of a cherry on top. It all means that, you know, sometimes private equity firms' interests are aligned with the companies they buy, but not always. And that seems to be what happened with Shopko.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Brenda joins us now in Menominee. Brenda, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Brenda?
Yeah, I'm just wondering, you know, why is it that these companies allow themselves to be bought by these private equity firms? Do they have a choice in the matter? What's in it for them?
Good question. Brendan.
Brenda, it's a great question. So sometimes, you know, a private equity firm can be genuinely helpful in sort of injecting capital into a business and so forth. I will say that oftentimes private equity acquisitions, you know, whether they work or not for the acquired company, can be extremely valuable for the executives of the company that's bought. You know, a lot of these executives are compensated in part or primarily in stock or other equity in the business. And so, you know, a buyout is an opportunity for those folks to cash out.
Brenda, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Brendan Ballou about his new book, Plunder, Private Equity's Plan to Pillage America. Evan joins us next in Viroqua. Evan, hi.
Hi. My question, I don't know if it pertains to this. I don't know if private equity is involved or not. But years ago, Kmart was struggling, and they were going to go through bankruptcy. And then the next thing I heard, they bought Sears, a bigger company than them. So, like, how does that work?
Evan, thanks for the call. Brendan, I don't know if that particular story was private equity, but you write it's very common for a private equity company to merge different companies in the same line of business.
Yeah, it's a great question, Evan. You know, I believe the Kmart story would be classified more as a hedge fund. And just to make the distinction clear, you know, hedge funds tend to invest in securities, stocks, bonds, and so forth. Private equity firms tend to buy whole companies. It's not a clear legal distinction, but that's sort of a rough division of labor there. So as you were saying, private equity firms often have a strong interest in mergers and acquisitions. And I already sort of touched on this a little bit when we were talking about veterinary clinics, but a lot of times private equity firms are interested in what are called roll-up opportunities. So these are chances to buy up businesses in a dispersed industry, combine them, and then, you know, potentially get efficiencies of scale, but also, you know, potentially, you know, raise prices or lower wages and things like that. So potentially we're seeing that happen in veterinary clinics, but we're seeing it happen in all sorts of industries. In healthcare, for instance, there's really interesting reporting on private equity firms getting interested in buying up small practices or clinics, OBGYN practices, oncology practices, urgent care, dermatology, and so forth. There's really interesting stories out there about private equity firms, after they bought dermatology clinics, were essentially making medical supply decisions on behalf of doctors. And at least according to one story, were buying needles that were so cheap that they would break off in people's arms. Now, pretty scary stuff. That's certainly not what always happens, but it is a common tactic of private equity firms. So it's a very good point.
Thanks for that call, Evan. I want to take our last few minutes, Brendan, on solutions you offer. You say it might be an uphill battle because the government, Congress, the White House has made it pretty easy to do these things. But you say there's room for some substantial changes. What kind of things would be at the top of your agenda?
So it goes back to the basic problems that we've got with the private equity business model. You know, short-term thinking, a reliance on debt and fees, and insulation from liability. And if you can solve those problems, private equity can be made to be a useful part of our financial system. You know, I always say, as long as companies need, to build factories and hire new workers, there needs to be somebody willing to take the bet and make the investment on that. Now, how do we do that? Congress can obviously pass legislation to address some of those flaws. But, you know, we live in a time of a divided Congress. And truthfully, there are a lot of other sort of levers of power where things can happen. whether we're talking about at the federal level, agencies like the Securities and Exchange Commission, Health and Human Services, Treasury Department, Federal Reserve, and so forth, can act. But also states and localities can, you know, modify their laws to make it harder to do some of the more extractive tactics that private equity firms do. So all of which is to say that there's a lot that can be, that should be done, and there are a lot of different ways that we could do it. So I think that there is some reason for optimism here.
Now, because these companies, they're huge, but they're not necessarily visible on a daily basis, are you hopeful that everyday people might look at this and advocate for some of the changes you're calling for?
Absolutely. You know, I think that, you know, people, whether they perceive it consciously or not, are affected by private equity every day. And there's a lot that ordinary people can do, whether it's, you know, getting involved in a specific organization and just Google private equity and, you know, you'll see some of the names that pop up, to just making your voice heard. I really can't emphasize enough, you know, how much hearing stories about how people are affected can really affect, you know, bureaucrats in Washington like me or, you know, people that are trying to make positive change.
Brendan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Brendan Belew, federal prosecutor who served as special counsel for private equity in the Justice Department's antitrust division. Again, he's not speaking for the Justice Department in this conversation. We talked with him about his new book. It's called Plunder, Private Equity's Plan to Pillage America. If you have a story about an encounter with a private equity in some part of your life, a good or bad, we would love to hear it. Email ideas@WPR.org. Do you work somewhere that has been, or did you work somewhere that has been taken over by a private equity company, or have you rented from them? They own a lot of houses. Have you yourself or a loved one been in a care center owned by one? Let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to the director of the UW Law School Immigrant Justice Clinic about the end of Title 42, a big border restriction that just ended last week, and new immigration rules put in place by the Biden administration. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, do you really need 10,000 steps a day? The research says you probably don't. We'll take a look at walking and fitness. Now, the health and immigration policy known as Title 42 expired last Thursday. It was used during the COVID-19 pandemic to prevent migrants from entering into the United States. Border officials warned that the end of Title 42 could immediately lead to a big jump in the number of migrants at entry points on the U.S. border with Mexico that were already dangerously overcrowded. It's still early days, but so far that doesn't seem to be what happened. The top border policy official at the Department of Homeland Security says the number of migrants crossing into the U.S. illegally has suddenly dropped by roughly half. Just south of El Paso, Texas, the mayor of the Mexican city of Juarez said on Monday that their migrant shelter was at 30% capacity and, quote, everything is completely under control. But border officials say the conditions causing high levels of migration haven't changed, and lawsuits filed by liberals and conservatives could disrupt new border policies from the Biden administration. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your opinion of the nation's immigration system, especially at that southern border? What do you think we could be doing better? What questions do you have? There's a lot of moving parts here. Have you entered the United States across that border? Would you care to share your experience? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Aaron Barbato is the director of the Immigrant Justice Clinic at the University of Wisconsin Law School. Aaron, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob.
Because this does get complicated, I want to do a little before and after comparison here. First of all, can you talk about what Title 42 was and what it meant for people trying to enter the country, especially those trying to claim asylum status?
Sure. Title 42 isn't actually an immigration law, but it allows, based on public health and welfare, the government to control the border in terms of for a health reason. So in March of 2020, I believe, President Trump enacted Title 42 to close the southern border to everyone, including people seeking asylum.
Now, that expired last week with the end of the COVID health emergency. The Biden administration has policies in place, some based on pre-COVID policies. What are the most important elements of what the White House has in place now?
So now with the end of Title 42, we look at our Title 8, which is covers aliens and nationality through the U.S. code. And that's normally what we're looking at. The laws haven't changed since 1980 in terms of people able to seek refuge or asylum in the U.S. The Biden administration recently very much changed some policies that will have a huge effect on people who are seeking asylum and the number of people that are even eligible to seek asylum on our southern border. There are also a lot of additional enforcement techniques that are going on at our border and even in Mexico and even as far south as Colombia near the Darien Gap. There are policies and programs that they're creating that are supposed to expand legal pathways for people to enter the U.S. so they don't have to make the dangerous journey. But many of them are not in action yet, and we're still waiting for those to be up and running.
Now, the difference, if someone is trying to enter the United States outside of a legal point of entry, without authorization, during Title 42, as I understand it, they might be quickly returned to Mexico or their country of origin. Now it seems things might be more stringent. They could face a 5-year ban from trying to enter the country again. They could face criminal charges for repeatedly doing so. What is different from that perspective now?
Yeah, under Title 42, where we did see high levels of unauthorized entries, Border Patrol was able to return people to their home country without going through what's called the expedited removal process. So they weren't allowed to apply for asylum. But there also wasn't a consequence. There was no criminal or immigration consequences for being turned around under Title 42. So many people did it more than once because there were no consequences to it. And maybe they would be successful the second time. Now under Title 8, we look at what is called expedited removal. It's if you arrive at a port of entry or enter the United States without authorization and you don't have proper documents, you will be removed unless you can prove that you have a fear of return to your home country. Now, if you can't prove that, you could be deported. There could be additional criminal consequences for entering the United States unlawfully more than once. So there are a lot more dangers for people attempting to enter the United States numerous times.
We're talking to Aaron Barbato, director of the Immigrant Justice Clinic at the University of Wisconsin Law School, talking about a big change in the policies in force at the Mexico-U.S. border. You can join in at 800-642-1234. With your questions for our guest, with changes, if any, you would like to see, call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Aaron, can you take us through the process? If I'm someone who is coming, say, from Central America, I want to cross in the United States. I want to make a claim of asylum. I want to try to do it right. I'm going to go through a recognized point of entry. What happens? What are the steps I go through at that point?
So if you're coming from a Central American country, let's say Honduras, you are going to pass through at least Guatemala and Mexico on your way to the southern border to attempt to apply for asylum. When people arrive near the southern border or in northern Mexico, there is now what's called the CBP-1 app, Custom Border Protection app, where you are supposed to apply for an appointment with CBP. Right now, it looks like they're allowing about 1,000 interviews a day, but the app is glitchy and you need to have high-speed internet in order to make the appointment. So a lot of people on the ground are having difficulties making this appointment. So that's going to be one very difficult process for that individual, for you coming from Honduras to apply for asylum. The other issue that you're going to face right now as the policy stands is what's similar to the former safe third country policy. So if you pass through a third country on your way to the southern border of the U.S., without applying for asylum in a different country first and being denied, you are not eligible for asylum in the U.S. So it is a, it's going to bar many, many people from even being eligible for asylum, even if they generally would have like a textbook claim. So people from Mexico who are seeking asylum, they won't pass through a third, say third country, because they're in Mexico next to the US. So they may be able to process for asylum, but everybody else, it will be extremely difficult, if not impossible.
What are the prospects for seeking asylum in Mexico? Is that more or less welcoming than applying for asylum in the United States?
You know, I don't know the intricacies of how things work. In Mexico, it's, the asylum program is much newer and it has grown, but it's, from what I hear from my clients, it's never an option for them, whether it's unavailable or they don't speak the same language or there isn't even a place to apply. So I don't think it's readily available for people to apply. And many of the people that are seeking asylum in the U.S. would face the same dangers in Mexico as they would in their home country.
Now, supposing I made it through that hurdle, I had applied for asylum in Mexico and could establish that at the border, then what? What kind of things do I have to successfully prove? Who do I prove it to make a potentially successful asylum claim?
So normally what happens, so if you apply for asylum in Mexico and you were denied, then you are attempting to go to the U.S. to apply for asylum, you would have to get an appointment on CBP One app or somehow present yourself to a CBP officer. Then there's a few, depending on who you are, you'll be treated in a different way. Most single adults traveling alone will process for asylum while in detention. But even to get into detention in the U.S., you would have to pass what's called your credible fear interview. This is an interview generally with an asylum officer to determine whether you have a likelihood of getting asylum while in the United States. This is not an easy bar to reach. But if you do pass your credible fear, proving that you have a fear of return to your home country based on your race, nationality, religion, political opinion, or membership in a particular social group, you may be able to enter the U.S., but be in a detention center while applying for asylum. That can be months. And these detention centers are carceral environments. If it's different for parents entering with children, it looks like they will be in detention for a little bit in CBP custody. And then if they pass their credible fear, they may be released from detention, knowing that they need to appear in immigration court eventually. And some of these families will also be monitored by ankle devices and phone monitoring by immigration officials. So there's no family detention that's coming back. At least Biden has said that's not coming back. But there will be a sense of detention where people, freedom of movement will not be available in the U.S. except in limited positions. And then an unaccompanied minor, there are specific processes for them as well.
Now, if my claim of asylum is denied, a big question all along is, where am I deported to? And if I have a correct, Aaron, it may vary from country to country, depending on where I'm from?
It does. We the U.S. can only deport people to countries that we have diplomatic relations with. And right now, we don't have those relations with Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Venezuela. But it seems like Mexico has agreed to accept them. So that is kind of the U.S.'s workaround from, they can't deport them to their home country, but they can deport them to Mexico.
We're talking to Aaron Barbato, director of the Immigrant Justice Clinic at the University of Wisconsin Law School. She's with us today for a look at the end of the Title 42 border policy and what things look like now with the Biden administration's current immigration enforcement rules. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of President Biden's immigration policy? What questions do you have about what's happening at the U.S.-Mexico border? How do you see immigration affecting us here in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Aaron Barbato, director of the UW Law School Immigrant Justice Clinic, talking about what's happening on the U.S. border with Mexico, what's leading people to immigrate to the United States, what the process looks like after the end of Title 42, a health code that was used as an immigration law in effect. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about what goes into these immigration policy decisions, the process for someone seeking to enter into the United States? Are there changes you would like to see? If you're someone who migrated to the United States, what do you want people to know about your experience? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll bring on a caller now. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi. So I guess what keeps coming to my mind is I'm wondering what would happen if all of a sudden we had to have a mass exodus out of the United States, if we were treated with such rough hands, you know, how that would work. And I don't really believe that the way this is being done is in any type of, in accord with any type of religious text, because all of them say take care of the widow, take care of children, take care of the traveler in a foreign land. And we're all immigrants if we're not Native American. So it just makes me think.
Marcus, thanks for the call. Marcus, I think looking for some empathy for people seeking to cross the border, Aaron, and having worked with people on their claims in some cases, can you talk about the sort of things that are, as Marcus suggests, leading them to have to leave their home country?
Yeah, I mean, I think what Marcus said is a lot of people are looking for empathy or for safety. And I think that's how our laws were created, that in certain situations, people deserve protection. And these new policies may decrease people from seeking asylum in the United States, but that doesn't mean that the harm that people are suffering decreases. So I think that's something that everyone needs to think about, and that as a country, we have in our laws, as well as morally, are able to protect certain people. And we've been trying to do that for years, but this is a very stringent law that's gonna exclude a lot of people that otherwise would qualify for asylum.
Marcus, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Aaron, you mentioned the stringency of this law. I know some groups that advocate for immigrants thought that President Biden would be less stringent, more welcoming than President Trump. Some complaining that they don't see as much difference. Can you compare the toughness, the stringency of Biden-era regulations that came into effect over the last week versus what we saw in the Trump era?
Yeah, I think it's fair commentary, especially towards this safe third country transit bar to asylum. But adding legal pathways through and processing centers in Colombia and Guatemala, as well as ways for people to sponsor individuals from certain countries of mostly Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Venezuela, I think those are steps in the right direction. I really want to lean into how we can reduce the harm that people suffer on their journey to seek asylum in the US. The harm that people face, especially if they're, you know, traveling on foot from the Darien Gap, the most dangerous passage in the world, to our southern border, it's extremely dangerous and run by many criminal organizations and gangs. So if we can get people here who are eligible without having them experience more persecution while they're seeking asylum, I think that's the right move in the right direction. But if everyone else who arrives at our southern border isn't eligible for asylum because they didn't apply for asylum in another country, that's not the way that that Biden would be expanding humanitarian government policies.
Let's go back to our callers. Charlie is with us in Fish Creek. Charlie, hi.
Hi, good morning. Good afternoon. Good morning. Hey, I was just thinking about the early days of the Trump administration when we had a Republican in the White House. We had Republicans dominating the House of Representatives, and the Republicans were controlling the Senate and a pretty Republican-based Supreme Court. If we really wanted to take care of immigration and put something forth that was lasting, it could have happened then. But I don't think that the political impetus is there to get that done, because it's a political football that can be kicked around every election cycle because it gets people out to vote. And if things look bad on the border, it rallies people. I'm not sure what you think about that, but I'll
I'll take the response off the air.
Charlie, thanks for the call. And yeah, you had mentioned, Aaron, it's been a long time since we've had significant changes in actual immigration law. We've been cobbling things together with various kinds of executive actions and court decisions. What do you think about Charlie's thoughts about why we haven't seen that kind of a reform in Congress?
Well, why we haven't seen a reform in Congress, I'm not quite sure. Seems that no one can agree on what to do, even with something as popular as something like the Dream Act to protect people with DACA. There's no movement on that. There's no movement on anything. And so what we are dealing with every few years is the executive taking action within their presumed powers to change policies in immigration. And it causes havoc within the systems in the US, as well as for misinformation and dangerous to people who are seeking asylum, because it's very difficult to understand what the rules are because they've changed so substantially. And people seeking asylum are often on journeys for months or even years. And those policies change and can affect their lives and their eligibility to apply for asylum simply by a change in a policy by the administrator. It's a very difficult, or the executive. So it's very difficult for people working in this area, but certainly for people seeking protection in the U.S.
Charlie, thanks for that call. I want to focus in on something you mentioned earlier, Aaron, these regional migration hubs. U.S. officials say they plan to open, I think, around 100 of these migration centers in countries including Colombia and Guatemala and elsewhere. From what you're looking at, do we know what role they'll have in immigration policy?
So it's my understanding that these, so one thing in our immigration system, there's a difference between someone seeking an asylee status and a refugee status. If someone receives a refugee status outside of the United States and the United States has room for them within their refugee numbers, they can fly to the United States and be accepted without going through the asylum process. My understanding is that's what the intention of these new processing centers will be. It will allow people to apply for, to meet the definition of a refugee there, and then not have to take the dangerous journey across Central America and Mexico to seek asylum, but they would go through the processing outside of the U.S., which potentially could be a much safer way to seek protection and permanent status in the U.S., but they're not up and running yet.
From your perspective with the Immigrant Justice Clinic, what things do you think would help in terms of processing asylum claims quickly and fairly at the border?
That's a good question. And, you know, I think having humanitarian government policies in line where we can provide safe shelter, ability for people to sleep and eat food before they're interviewed by an asylum officer who is well-trained in trauma as well as country conditions. The asylum system is incredibly backlogged. And so when someone goes into the court system, they're going to be waiting for years. Sometimes if they're in detention, it will go faster, but the trauma of being in detention is really pretty difficult. So we need better policies and procedures for processing people in a more humane manner.
And briefly, this is a part of your work. How about access to legal counsel for people seeking asylum?
Yes, that's super important. As many people know, if you're in the immigration, if you're in removal proceedings and applying for asylum, you can have an attorney represent you, but you have to be able to pay for them or find a pro bono attorney to represent you. There's simply not enough resources for people to be represented in these proceedings if they have to afford an attorney, which is thousands of dollars, which many people don't have when they arrive to the U.S. And you are much more likely to be successful and receive access to justice if you're represented by an attorney who is well-versed in the asylum law.
Aaron, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Aaron Barbato, director of the Immigrant Justice Clinic at the University of Wisconsin Law School. She joined us today to explain U.S. immigration policy, especially asylum status, now that Title 42 has expired and how new policies are affecting immigration on the U.S.-Mexico border. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. If you are in the market for a new or used car, there are a lot of options out there. Auto expert Jamie Page Deaton joins the show with lots of advice and answers to your questions. You can get started with your questions or share a recent car buying experience of your own. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Then join the conversation tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. A while back, I talked about a woman in Spain who lived for hundreds of days alone in a cave for science. Here's another story along those lines. Again, for science, a professor in Florida just broke the world record for living underwater without depressurization, like you'd do in a submarine. That new record is 74 days and counting. He plans to add a few more weeks onto that. As reported by NPR, Joseph Dottori of the University of South Florida has been living in an underwater bunker 30 feet below the surface of a lagoon in Key Largo. He's got 100 square feet to work with. It includes a sleeping area, a living room, tiny kitchen. It's part of a research project to understand the effects of living under high pressure on the human body. He's aiming for a full 100 days before he checks out of his lodging, and he says he's looking forward to some sunlight. Now, I just got a board game called Underwater Cities. This research could be a first step toward making that a reality. But I'm not holding my breath. This is Central Time.